You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Catherine Greider hired an architect to propose some relatively routine maintenance work on her Lower East Side co-op building, she had no idea what she and her family were getting into. The foundation of the three-family home, which had literally supported her and her family for almost a decade, was in complete disrepair, so much so that the building had to be evacuated. Amid the flood of emotions this news evoked was an overarching question. What happened here? And she put her answers, which came after doing considerable research into New York's history, in her new book called The Archaeology of Home, an epic set on 1,000 square feet of the Lower East Side. It's published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased to welcome Catherine Greider to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You begin your book with the phone call. What was that?
Well, we had had some ominous signs that the house was not in the best of shape. And the most serious of these signs was that there was a crack, a fissure that had opened up in the front facade, which actually had a corresponding crack on the inside of our apartment. So,
and you could see that?
We could see it. And this had developed during the course of our living there. And there was even a little crack between the stairwell and the supporting wall, which had opened up. So we could actually observe these things developing. And so we were actually quite worried, and we and our co-owners hired this architect who was going to give us sort of a set of repairs that would kind of fix the problem.
Well, hadn't you had an engineer inspect the place before you bought into it? This is a co-op.
Right.
You were one of three people who owned the building, but you had the most space, so you were the most important.
Right. Well, we had the biggest vote, so to speak. Yes, we had hired an engineer. My husband and I were, expecting our first child, and we had lived on the block for 5 years. We wanted to buy this place, and we were quite eager because we loved the block. But yes, we did hire an engineer. He took a look, and I remember him saying, it's actually in pretty good shape considering its age.
You could sue that guy, right, for malpractice?
Well, some people suggested that, but the fact of the matter is that we couldn't really have known what was going on inside those walls at the time.
So getting back to the phone call.
Right.
It said you had to move out?
Right. The guy said, instead of saying, well, here's what we're going to do, he said, what you're going to do, and we're going to do it immediately, is get the hell out of there. And so we had to do that over a weekend and move, sort of years' worth of accumulated stuff if we could.
And was there a sense that the place could be repaired and you could move back, or were you just going to have to leave and see what you could salvage of the building?
Well, this was the big open question at the time. And one of the things that made it so confusing is that, we really considered this our home and the place where we wanted to raise our children. But we didn't know whether we'd ever be able to return or not. We didn't know whether it could be repaired. So that was an open question for quite a few months.
What about the other families in the building?
Well, there were two co-owners who owned, two different floors, and one was living in the basement, one owner, and the others were renters. So they had their own opinions about what should be done, and we were sort of a very quarrelsome bunch, and we mucked our way along trying to figure this out for quite some time.
And when did you decide to start doing research into what had happened?
Well, it's funny because it's almost hard to trace back exactly when I was doing the research for its own sake. It became interesting to me quite early on.
First, you were just trying to find out what had happened and how it affected you and how to proceed in the future.
Right. I mean, that question, what happened here, was a quite practical question at the beginning. You mentioned lawsuits. We were thinking, we had bought this place not so long ago, and why was it in a completely ruined condition now, So one of the first things I did was to pull the old buildings department file, which was actually in the archives. And that was sort of what has happened to this building as a structure.
Well, had renovations been done over the years?
Numerous renovations had been done. And that was one of the things that I learned about. And one of the big moments for me was the renovation that I thought had taken place in 1975, because it said on the permit, Alt 75, when I actually opened it up, opened the file, I saw that it was all in pen and ink and obviously ancient. And the date was 1875.
So the building was already in trouble in 1875?
Right, because the application was to not only expand the building, but it said we're going to remove the rear wall because it's in a very unsafe condition.
When was this built?
Well, I figured out that it was built in 1845. Not that there are any actual records to say that, but the way I figured that out was looking at the tax assessments.
Well, there are many buildings in New York that were built in the 1840s that are doing quite nicely. What was the problem here?
Well, that's absolutely true. And I think one of the big problems, the big problem, the sort of coup de grace, stemmed from a period in this neighborhood that was extremely destructive, and that's the 1970s and early 1980s.
But by the time you moved in, it was going through a gentrification period.
Right. By the time I was moved in, the building itself had been prettified, and the neighborhood also, to a fair extent, had been kind of ritzed up. But during the 1970s, there was a real sort of physically destructive disinvestment and the fires and demolitions. And so to answer your question, what happened was the building next door had been burned out, abandoned, and demolished.
And was there anything underneath the foundation that would have made the building more unstable? Because it sounds like it's resettling.
Right. Well, that was a process that stemmed from, you know, the underlying topography of the building. And this was something that I'd heard about in kind of this charming, mythical way that I became confronted in a very concrete way here, which is that it had been a salt marsh. It had been a tidal salt marsh, which means very soft, silty soil. And indeed, an underwater stream that was quite close to the site of the building. And that's what it was built on.
Were you able to track down people who had lived there before and find out whether they had been concerned?
Well, you know, I don't think anybody, except for the more recent people who lived there during the 70s and 80s, had been.
But it was
really
made into a co-op. It,
right.
Buildings were all converted around the 70s and 80s, weren't they?
Right. And that same thing happened here. Our building had been essentially abandoned. I mean, there was one family still there. There was a guy running a shooting gallery. And then a guy came along and bought it sort of at the same moment, basically, that the next door building was being demolished. And he tried to renovate it, did the best that he could, and then sold it to somebody who made it into a co-op, which happened to something sort of like that happened to a lot of buildings in the neighborhood.
New York City history ended up being a major part of the story of your building's decay. Early on in your attempts to salvage the building, your contractor, Richard, faxed you over a copy of, is it Viel's?
Yeah, Viel's
water map?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a famous map, actually, that shows the original topography that underlay Manhattan before it was turned into a grid. And, of course, it was quite a varied topography. There were hills and stone outcroppings and ponds and streams. And so he was quite excited because this showed that not only was it within this marsh, but there was this stream that lay almost directly in the path.
And there are streams all over Manhattan. Every so often you see something leaking out in the subway, and you realize there's still an underground stream there. We just flattened everything and put asphalt over the streets. And in certain areas, it's not very difficult to build tall, but you couldn't have built tall in the Lower East Side.
No, you couldn't have, and they didn't have the pile driving back then, you know, when they built this building that they do now. But, the whole process of filling in this meadow was really crazy.
Was this part of the grid?
Well, it was part of the grid, yes. The grid was laid over it when it was devised in 1811. There had been a lot of plans for how Manhattan would be developed, and the property owners had their own plans.
And way back when, Viel predicted that the water under Manhattan wouldn't disappear just because Manhattanites were building over it.
Yeah, and he had almost this idea that, you know, we're going to get this comeuppance. I mean, at the time, in the 19th century, moisture, the wetness, was dreaded for a somewhat different reason. I mean, they had the problem of flooding basements, but they also had the problem of disease. And so he thought that all of this underground moisture was creating a miasma that was carrying disease.
My guest is Catherine Greider, who's written a book called The Archaeology of Home, an epic set on 1,000 square feet of the Lower East Side. It's published by Public Affairs. Well, this area had been home to the Lenape Indians. The Dutch settlers had been there. Who built the building originally? Was this built as a private home?
Well, it was built by a lawyer and a judge who was a local guy. I mean, I actually don't know that for sure, because all I know, like I said, is that he owned the building at the time. His name was Gilbert Speer, and he owned the building. He owned the lot. Let me correct myself. He owned the lot and a couple of other lots at the time the building was built.
But this was probably designed as a private home, a one-family home.
Well, I actually think that he had it as a rental property, because he lived in a sort of more fashionable neighborhood in Greenwich Village. It's often believed, because all of these buildings that were built before the tenements went up, the 5- and 6-story tenements went up, they look like single-family homes. And they often, because a lot of them are still there, have been romanticized in that way. But I found out, looking at the census from 1855, the state census in 1850, that they were always occupied as multiple dwellings.
So this is like pre-tenement tenements.
Exactly.
Before they started building the larger ones. You mentioned that there was a bleak period, and it was almost completely missing documentation, the 1970s and 80s.
Yeah, it was strange.
Were squatters living in some of these buildings?
Yes, squatters were all over the place at that time. And part of the reason that period was actually, ironically, more difficult to document is because the census and other things are actually not available. You can't get all of the information, personal information that you can from earlier on, where you can actually look inside these households and see exactly who was there. But it was also that, you know, people didn't have telephones. I was able to look at these reverse directories that are based on telephone lines. But some people, you know, it was extremely poor at the time, and there were families that didn't have telephones and were basically not kind of leaving records.
But you kind of can figure out what happened on the Lower East Side by looking at some of the nicknames the area has had over the years, some of them complimentary and some of them not so complimentary.
Right. Right, and kind of representing the different groups, you know. I mean, there was Klein Deutschland, you know, which was the Germans who kind of rose up from their original area of settlement further south and lived there. And then I was interested to know that the name we usually use now, which is the East Village, was actually coined more by the hippies in the 1960s, who came in and for a sort of brief time. And there were lots of, you know, head shops and T-shirt shops and, you know, vegan restaurants and this sort of thing.
Well, there's a wonderful park nearby. It actually should be considered prime real estate.
Tompkins Square Park you're referring to? Yeah. Yeah, and right now, I mean, Tompkins Square, there's no lovelier place in all of New York, I think. But
you also researched the people who'd lived there before and felt a certain kind of connection to the Hart family.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this was a particularly sort of interesting and really heartbreaking story to me, because her parents were named Phillips, actually, and it was three generations at one point in this house that I lived in. Rachel Hart was their eldest child, and she lived there with her two young children after her husband died of diphtheria. And just the sort of the way her life unspooled reflected the limitations on her choices that had to do with the time and the place where she lived.
I'm not doing a spoiler here if I say that you don't live there anymore.
Right. No,
and the building doesn't even exist anymore?
Well, it's funny. It's still a building, but it's a different building. I mean, it's got an extra story, and it was basically dismantled from the inside out. And so there are steel beams, and it's a completely different building.
A lot of the more personal aspects of the story you tell here are your attempts to figure out what makes a place into a home. Have you, now that you've written the book, come to any answer for yourself?
Yeah. Well, I think it's this incredible creative human process where the person invests, feels like he or she fills the whole space, because you invest it with meaning, with your personal meaning. And at the same time, you take it in, and so you keep inside of yourself this incredibly intricate image of it that you know how to work with. You can carry it with you and almost put it down someplace else and recreate that place in quite specific detail without even thinking about it.
Every so often, there's a story of a building collapse somewhere around the city. Do you think it's mostly because of the reasons this building had so many problems, or?
Yeah. Well, that had, I think that that is often the case, that there's something, you know, these, our building was built with party walls with its neighbor, so that it was really a single wall, and it wasn't intended to, it wasn't built to stand up without its neighbor.
So if a building next door or somewhere on the block is burned out or has to be taken down for some reason, every other building is affected. It's kind of like a domino effect.
Right. Well, I wouldn't say every. I mean, specifically the next door building. But the other thing that will affect these old buildings is construction. Like if there's pile driving or, you know, major changes that are going on in the soil nearby, that can also, you know, the shaking can make a building crack like ours had.
Do you miss the block?
You know, I live pretty nearby now, so I can go there anytime I want. And no, I wouldn't say that I do. I mean, it's a, it sort of represents a part of my life, and I'm very fond of it. But I, you know, I like where I am now, and I'm happy with that.
Katherine Greider is a journalist who's written The Big Fix, How the Pharmaceuticals Industry Rips Off American Consumers, earlier for Public Affairs, now a very different kind of book. The Archaeology of Home, an epic set on 1,000 square feet of the Lower East Side. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.